What did she want to say? What could she say? She couldn't bring her martyr or sister back from the dead, nor their father, who had seemed dead for a long time. And maybe now he really was. She also couldn't promise that she would never leave. Nor should she. Whisper was next in line for the Empire, and babying her now would only cripple her. "I miss them," she said instead. Whisper's eyes finally met hers.
"I can't breathe sometimes," she said breathlessly.
"I know."
"Do you really?"
Whisper snapped, her voice turning to steel. Well, at least as much as it could.
"You're talking of war, Raven. You sound just like them. Martyr, fartyr, fire. That's all they cared about. And where did that get them? It got them dead."
"I'm not them. I'm being more cautious." Whisper shook her head, pursing her butterfly lips.
"You're not. You just agreed that if the Dragonia pass the testing, that they'll be ready for battle, even if they're not fully grown."
So she was listening, Raven thought, surprised. "I didn't make any decision other than to test the dragons. And they won't pass."
"You can't know that. And anyway, you sent 30 Guanero to the border. To stop a war. To start a war."
Whisper fired back. When had her youngest sister become so tenacious?
"This is how it happens. This is how it always happens. One side attacks, the other side counters with a larger force, and on, until everyone is dead and I'm alone again."
The fight left her, and Whisper's head slumped into her lap. Her shoulders began to shake, the soft sound of muffled weeping rising to fill the sudden silence. If someone entered the room now, Raven couldn't let anyone see her sister like this. Sans women did not cry or show weakness in public, if ever. Raven slipped off her throne, roping an arm around her sister's shoulders.
"Come, let us return to our quarters. A cold drink and a bath will serve you well."
Whisper squirmed away.
"Stop coddling me," she said, dashing her hand across the tears on her cheeks.
Her eyes were wet and red, but still sharp.
"I'll go myself."
As Raven gaped at her, she stalked off, the hem of her dark dress brushing the floor behind her. Raven shook her head, still trying to come to terms with this new, fierier version of Whisper. Just then, one of the Empire messengers entered, bowing slightly at the waist. He wore baggy white pants cinched at his knees, and a grey vest with three silver buttons.
"Two messages have arrived," he said, handing her a freshly streamed note on moist parchment.
He stepped back twice, giving her space to read in private.
"What now?" Raven thought.
She scanned the letter, her eyes widening when she noticed the sender, Aunt Viper. The strangeness wasn't in the message itself, which was of a mundane nature, a recent profit report from the fighting pits of Zune, of which Viper was the mistress overlord, but the fact it was sent at all. She hadn't heard from her aunt in years, not even after her mother's death. She realized the messenger was still standing, waiting, another message in hand. She folded her aunt's stream for later consideration.
"Where is the second message from?"
she asked the messenger.
"I'm not sure."
Raven frowned.
"To where was it streamed?"
Generally, certain senders used the same locations again and again.
"It wasn't streamed, Empress. It came via pigeon."
The man held up a sealed scroll. Raven's frown deepened. Since streaming, the instantaneous method of sending messages using ink reeds through the water network, was invented, people rarely used birds anymore. The messengers generally just ran from the stream locations to deliver their messages and back again.
"Approach."
He strode forward once more and handed her the scroll.
"Thank you. That is all."
The messenger left, but Raven barely noticed, because she was staring at the wax used to seal the rolled parchment. It was blood red and printed with a strange symbol, a sickle. In the south, the sickle was associated with the god of the void, or underworld, Dragonus. She cracked the seal and unfurled the scroll. The succinct message was scrawled in red ink. Stop war, or Whisper dies. Raven stared at the words, her breath stuck in her chest. The ink smelled distinctly metallic, coppery. From experience, Raven knew that smell. The message was written in blood. 59. The Southern Empire, somewhere off the coast of Fanes. Grey Aris. Grey Aris was still getting used to this different version of his sister, Shay. Sure, she'd always been strong-willed, outspoken. Stubborn as a mule, Shay was, if Grey was being honest. But this Shay was all those things and something else. Something more. When she looked at him, as she was doing now, her gaze seemed to pierce him to the core, as if she was seeing his demons, his memories, his faults and his burdens. "We are close," she said now, snapping him away from his ruminations. "Close to what?" he asked. But her stare had already moved on, out to sea, settling on something perhaps only she could see. She didn't respond. Something else Grey was still getting used to. When she was like this, Grey knew it was fruitless to try to badger her further. It was like she'd folded into herself, a bat tucking its wings around its body, hiding in plain sight. On the Dead Isles, Shay had been through hell and back, and Grey wasn't about to push her until she was ready. All he really knew was that she'd dreamed about a man, a pirate, who was marked with the other half of the symbol on her palm, the one she'd been born with. Together, their two symbols formed a key, apparently. A key to open what, neither of them knew. Solving the mystery was the primary reason why they were now heading on a southerly bearing toward Pirate's Peril, an island off the southwestern coast of Fanes. As its name suggested, the isle was the known hideout of a notorious band of pirates operating in the burning sea. Watching her stare out to sea, Grey had the urge to ask Shay more about her dreams, what the pirate looked like, why he, of all people, would bear the other half to her mark. Instead, with the sun peeking over the horizon, he left her alone, off to see if Kyla, the captain's daughter, was awake yet. Stomping across the foredeck, he passed several seamen, each of whom greeted him with respectful nods and tipped caps. It was an abrupt change to the way they'd treated him before, back when he'd been known simply as the Cripple. Strangely, their newfound respect made him uncomfortable. As he approached the stairs below decks, Captain Smithers himself emerged, blinking against the brightness of daybreak. Garbed in faded trousers held up by an old leather belt with a dull silver buckle, a stained button-down shirt and a floppy brown cap, the captain could have been just another seaman starting work for the day. But Grey knew better. When the captain barked orders, his men listened, else they faced the stiff edge of his walking stick. Grey had known the captain's wrath in the past, though now the man generally looked at him with a similar respect to his men. Thus far, the captain had promised to take them within rowing distance of Pirate's Peril. Smithers had said that any additional help beyond that was to be discussed in good time. They also had yet to speak about where the captain's daughter's place in all this was. Grey had been avoiding the conversation for a week. "Well met, Seaman Aris," the captain said now. "Well met, Captain," Grey said, removing his cap, his unruly black hair spilling out. "You're up early?" "Sleep is hard to find these days," Grey explained. In truth, he'd been up for several hours already, passing the early morning beside Shay, who seemed to sleep even less than he. Their pre-dawn vigil had become somewhat of a ritual. As usual, they'd spoken little, watching the Phoenician coastline pass like the ghost of an enormous beast in the dark. A few days earlier, the smoke that had blanketed Fanes had dispersed, leaving the sky clear.
"For me as well."
The captain squinted into the distance, searching the red Phoenician cliffs they'd been staring at for a week.
"We'll all rest easier once we've passed the Southron Peninsula."
Grey didn't know if that was true, but he agreed anyway, suddenly anxious to see Kyla. "Is your daughter awake yet?" The captain grinned knowingly. He not only supported his daughter's interest in Grey, but openly encouraged it, an abrupt turnaround from when he'd forbidden them from seeing each other. Grey had showed her kindness, and to a father that was much the same as retrieving the moons for her.
Last I saw, she was dead to the world. Feel free to wake her, though, else she'll sleep till midday.
Thank you, Captain, Gray said over his shoulder, descending the steps. Below decks, the corridor was grim, the barest sliver of sunlight finding its way onto the landing. The first door on the right was the captain's quarters, which belonged to Smithers and Kyler. Gray smoothed his salt-stained shirt with his hand before raising his fist to knock. The door opened before he could finish the gesture, a hand shooting out to grab his collar. Off balance, he found himself being pulled inside the chamber by Kyler, who proceeded to kiss him hard on the lips, stealing his breath. When she pulled away, he gasped.
"What was that for?"
he asked. Not that he minded. Her brown curls bouncing, Kyler said,
"For being you. For being here."
She had that telltale twinkle in her eyes, the barest of smiles on her lips. Combined with her button nose, rich brown skin, and sharp eyebrows, he found everything about her utterly attractive. He leaned down to scoop a hand around her waist, using his stump to support her waist as he leaned her back and kissed her deeply. She came up, giggling.
"What was that for?"
"That was good morning," Gray said. The entire exchange left him giddy. Though their brief but intense romance felt sweeter than his last relationship, it was no less passionate. His smile quickly faded, however, when he saw Kyla's bottom lip begin to quiver.
"Oh, gods, Kyler," he said,
pulling her into his chest. She nuzzled against him, unfurling her arms around his back. She didn't have to say anything. He knew.
"You had the same dream."
She shook her head, her voluminous hair tickling his chin.
"Almost. Except..."
She trailed off.
"Take your time,"
Gray said, cupping her chin, lifting her gaze to his. "I have all day." A shadow smile creased her lips.
"What about your daily tasks? The decks won't scrub themselves."
"I could skip a week, and your father would still think I walk on water."
"But you won't."
"I will if you need me to." She dipped her head again, pressing her lips against his chest. He could feel the warmth as she kissed him through his shirt.
"Where did you come from?"
she asked.
"Night's End," he said,
though he knew that wasn't what she meant. Though he'd told her a lot about his past, about his parents' deaths, about Shay's sin mark, about the furious capture of her and his subsequent mission to save her, he hadn't told her everything. He hadn't admitted to being a thief in a past life, nor that he'd bedded Princess Rhea under the false name Grease Jolly. He didn't know why, exactly, he'd withheld these things. It wasn't as if Kyla was naive. She'd grown up a captain's daughter, spending her time amongst cursing, gambling, spitting seamen.
"No," he thought. "I do know why. I'm ashamed."
She believed him a hero, when he was nothing but a recovering crook and swindler. Could present goodness wash away past badness? It was a question he'd struggled with for some time. In the end, he'd had to put it into the voluminous category of things he didn't know. All he could do was try his best to do good going forward, and protect his sister and Kyla and those he cared about. Still, despite Kyla's strength, sometimes Gray felt she was as fragile as a crystalline swan, ready to shatter if the wind blew in the wrong direction. Kyla began telling him about her dream. Much of it was the same as her previous ones had been. Her daughter, Myrie, who had arrived stillborn, drifting away on her floating casket, her eyes suddenly flashing open, as brown as Kyla's skin, the baby's sharp intake of breath, the crying. But from there the dream changed. The child stood, a babe no more, and its eyes were sparkling blue, its blonde hair sunlit, its cheeks fair and rosy. Gray frowned when her story ended. He'd seen her baby. Her skin was a rich brown, albeit not quite as dark as Kyla's. And her head had been covered with a thin layer of black hair, plastered to its scalp by birthing fluid and blood.
"That doesn't make sense," Gray said.
"I know."
They held each other in silence for several minutes, both lost in their own thoughts.
"Are you okay?"
Grey finally asked. He might not be able to interpret the dream, but he could comfort its recipient.
I don't know. It was hard enough losing her, but to have to see her again every night, and then to have her change like that, into someone else's child, it feels like torture. Every time I wake up out of breath, like I've run a great distance.
Grey raised an eyebrow. Is that what you think? That you were seeing someone else's child? She looked up at him, her eyes shining with unshed tears.
Maybe. I don't know why I said that. But there was something else.
What?
The child bore a strange marking.
Grey's blood turned to ice. The only skin mark he'd ever seen was Shay's, her half-key that didn't seem to do anything.
What marking? Well, I don't know if it was a marking, exactly. 5 letters. A word. H-O-R-D-E.
Horde? Grey said.
What is that supposed to mean?
Kyla shrugged, finally pulling away from him.
Probably nothing. But I felt scared when I saw it.
Land ho!
The scout shouted from the crow's nest. As Grey looked up at him, he waved his hat wildly over his head. The other shipmen began to gather on deck, craning their heads over the railing and peering into the distance. Without the spyglass used by the scout, all they could see were endless waters. Though Grey had expected to hear just such a cry for a few days now, it still sent a sensation through him. He didn't know why, exactly, except that something about it felt like he was turning another page in the book of his life. Thus far, every new chapter had brought massive changes, not just in scenery, but in him. He wondered what kind of person would emerge at the end of this chapter, assuming he emerged at all. The weather had grown steadily warmer as they'd sailed south, while the wind had slowly died down. He could feel the beads of sweat forming on his forehead, trickling down his cheeks, occasionally dripping from his chin. He was also nervous, because he'd run out of time to talk to the captain about his daughter. He could imagine the conversation in his head.
"What are your intentions toward my daughter?"
"I like her."
"Is that a question, son?"
"I don't think so."
Grey groaned, just thinking about it.
"Harris!"
Smithers shouted now, as if reading his mind.
"In my office!"
Grey scanned the deck for Kyla or Shay, but found neither of them. The men winked at him, smirking, as if he'd been caught with his hand in the coin box. There was nothing for it. He headed below decks, passing the closed door to the captain's quarters. He wondered if Kyla was inside, awaiting to hear news of her fate. On the left were the seamen's bunks, where he'd slept for the last several weeks, ever since he'd talked his way onto the duel in the first place. Surprisingly, he felt a pang of melancholy in his chest. His top bunk was lumpy and uncomfortable, lacking even a proper pillow, but he would miss it all the same, especially since twice Kyla had snuck in for a midnight cuddle. At the end of the corridor was a scratched oak door with a miniature version of a ship's wheel nailed into it. He collected his nerve, took a deep breath, and then knocked.
"Get in here!"
the captain's gruff voice shouted. Grey cringed, but opened the door. Inside, Captain Smithers sat behind a scratched-up old desk covered with various items typical in a merchant vessel's office. Signed contracts, a brass compass, dozens of nautical maps, a tin lockbox. His eyes narrowed at Grey as he entered.
"You think me a damn fool!"
the dark-skinned man bellowed. Grey froze. This wasn't the beginning to the conversation he'd expected.
"No, I don't know what you're talking about."
He took a step into the cramped room, closing the door behind him, which was when he noticed two others in attendance, Kyla and Shay. They were side by side, stuffed into a corner. Shay refused to look at him. Kyla's eyes met his, and she mouthed,
"I'm sorry."
"Sorry for what?" The captain glared at him.
"Kyla here was just telling me how you've been boasting about stealing her away, whisking her off on some fool-brained adventure in the land of the pirates."
Ray's jaw fell open. Not only had he and Kyla not discussed anything of the sort, but he didn't take her for the type to tell such a lie, especially to her father. He turned to meet her eyes, but she'd looked away. No, I'm not planning to steal your daughter away. I never said that.
Then, what are you planning?
Here it was, the conversation. Gray collected his thoughts, determined not to say anything he would regret later. The truth is, Captain, I barely know what I'm going to eat for breakfast, much less my plans for the future. All I know is that I care about your daughter deeply, more than I've cared about anyone in my life, save my sister, I suppose. And I know I must, once more, thrust myself into danger for the sake of learning about Shay's marking, as I've told you. If I may have a rowboat, I will make the attempt on my own, asking only that you protect Shay and Kyla in my absence. If I manage to escape the isle at some point, I will seek you out along your merchant route.
Is that all?
The captain growled, as if Gray was asking for the clothes off his very back. Gray nodded, holding his breath. The captain leaned forward, his jaw trembling with what appeared to be rage. And then he coughed, his face changing, a laugh bursting from his mouth, spluttering out with a splash of spittle. Gray raised his eyebrows as Smithers slapped both knees with vigour, all the while laughing so hard Gray thought the captain's head might fall from his neck. Gray turned to Kyla and Shay to find them both laughing too, though not nearly as hard as the captain. He felt like the butt of a jape he'd completely missed the punchline for.
"I should have been a play actor,"
Smithers finally said, wiping his eyes, which were moist with amused tears.
"You should have seen your face, sailor. White as a ghost 'twas."
Gray was still trying to catch up, but he thought maybe the reaction was a good thing. "So you're loaning me the rowboat?" That spurred another round of laughter.
"After what ye did to the last boat I loaned ye, never again,"
Smithers said.
"No, I don't trust ye with me stuff. My daughter, aye, but not me vessels."
"What are you saying?" Gray said slowly.
"Tell him, lass,"
Smithers said, gesturing to Kyla. She was beaming.
"We're coming with you, Gray."
"What?
No, you can't."
This, of all things, was not what he wanted. Pirate's peril was a danger he and he alone would face. The captain stood, moving around the desk to slap him hard on the back.
"We can, and we will. That's the deal, unless he'd rather swim."
Gray groaned. "Sailing a merchant vessel into pirate's peril is like..." He searched for the right comparison.
"Like a lamb wandering into a lion's den,"
the captain offered, looking all too pleased with himself.
"'Bout right, I expect."
"But the other men?"
"They've already agreed to it, days ago."
Gray shook his head, trying to make sense of the nonsensical.
"Kyla?"
Kyla said,
"I'm going, Gray. I told you you're stuck with me. Get used to it."
"Shay?" Shay, still grinning, said,
"This was always my path. I think we both know that."
Gray did. Though he'd had the best intentions of slipping away on his own to seek answers on her behalf, in the honest part of his heart he always knew she wouldn't allow it. Nor was it his place to do so.
"Why?"
Gray asked the captain, who'd stuffed a plug of tobacco under his lip. He chewed for a minute and then spit in a tin cup.
"Boredom, I guess. Me and me men, we've been sailing this route for a long time. Too long. It's exhausting. We barely turn a profit as 'tis. A bit of a pirate adventure seems just the thing we need."
Gray didn't know about that, but he also knew having a ship would offer them a much greater chance of escape when the time came. He had nothing else to say other than,
"Thank you, Captain, for everything."
The man's smile faded away as he said,
"Don't make me regret it, son."
60. The Southern Empire Fanes. Jai Jaru. Vin Hosa, the slave master, was dead. And yet nothing had changed. After that fateful night in which it felt as if everything had changed, when the metaphorical chains were broken, the slave marks vanishing from thousands of slaves' necks across Fanes, Garadia Mine, Jai's prison, had erupted in cheers. Men, women, and children, most of Terran or Dreadnought or origin, had rushed through the tunnels, racing for the mine's entrance. They could smell freedom, sweet and fragrant. Finally, at long last, within their reach. The masters, including Mine Master Axa, had reacted swiftly, slipping from the cavern and dropping the steel gate, barricading the mob inside. One of the masters had been too slow. There wasn't much left of him when the mob had finished. The previously docile slaves had raged, screaming threats and curses through the bars, but their words were empty, lost on the wind. A day later, the reinforcements arrived from the canyon city of Fenir. Hundreds of armed soldiers trained in the martial art of Fenru marched on the mine. By then, hungry and exhausted, the slaves had had no choice but to succumb to the force gathered against them. The few who had fought back were killed, an example set for the remaining slaves. It was at that moment that Jai Jaru, previous Garadia mine master, realized two things. First, that it had never been Vin Hosa and his slave mark alone that had enslaved the people. Second, that true escape was impossible so long as a Hosa ruled the empire. It was these two truths that fed him now, day by day, as he toiled alongside his people in the mines, chiseling away rock to uncover enough raw diamonds to make the new emperor of Fanes, Vin's son, Falcon, a very rich man. All the while, Jai was making plans. Not to escape, no, such notions had been futile, pointless. Childish dreams as unattainable as touching the stars in the night sky. Weighed down by ball and chain and a heavy axe he swung again and again and again, he glanced down the line of slaves. There was poor Jig with his gimpy foot, gathering rock dust to be sifted. There was Sonica Vade, the previous leader of the all-female rebel group known as the Black Tears, her eyes as dark and sly as ever, hammering away. Twice since her slave mark vanished, she'd attempted to escape. Now her strong back bore the scars from the beatings. In private, out of earshot from the mine masters, she told Jai she would keep trying until she succeeded, or died in the attempt. One didn't cage someone like Sonica Vade and expect a good result. Jai had other plans. This time, he would fight back. Gods help anyone who tried to stop him.
"We're leaving tonight,"
Sonica hissed. Her smooth brown skin was dotted with black tears, permanently etched in her flesh. A reminder. Once Jai had believed the rumors that each tear was for someone she'd killed. Instead, each tear was for someone she'd lost. Sonica Vade had a lot of tears. Too many. Jai shook his head. "It's too soon. The masters are watching you and the black tears like vultures." Sonica looked away, scanning the cavern they ate in, slept in, bathed in, lived in. She'd been the one to give these slaves freedom once, even if it wasn't permanent, and Jai wouldn't be surprised if she accomplished the same thing a second time. If she didn't get herself killed first. When she looked back at Jai, her face was determined.
"I can't stay another night in this place. I have to try. The tears are ready. It's already planned."
Jai knew there was no point arguing further. It would only draw attention, and when Sonica had made up her mind about something, there was no changing it.
"May Sarai's light shine upon you."
"Thank you. But the Goddess of Light can shine on you too, Jai. Come with us."
A swell of sadness rose inside him. In truth, he wanted nothing more than to escape this place. And he would, eventually. But under his own terms, in his own way. The wheels were already turning, just in a different direction. "We will meet again," he said. "I promise. It will be a beautiful day indeed." He lifted her fingers to his lips and kissed them. She was the sister Jai had never had. When he met her eyes again, He was surprised to see tears sparkling in them, more beautiful than the diamonds speckling the mine walls. And then she was gone, carrying her lead ball on her shoulder, her chains clanking. He hoped he wouldn't see her again, but feared he would, fresh scars etched into her back.
"You're not eating," Morella said, nodding toward Jai's plate.
He flushed. He hadn't even realized she'd filled his plate with the day-old bread and mushy beans. His mind had been elsewhere, wondering where Sonika and her tears were. The mine had been a buzz ever since they escaped the night before.
"She did it," Jai thought.
"She really did it." He knew he shouldn't be surprised. She was the most capable woman he'd ever met, save perhaps for Shanti, but he was. Garadia was a fortress these days, with more mine masters than Jai had ever seen in one place in his life. Other slaves were talking about revolting, but they were a minority. Since the escape, the guards had used their whips more. Jai knew an outright revolution wasn't the answer. Sonika would do her part, he was certain, but it still wouldn't be enough. The only answer was to fight from within. It was something he'd believed in as a mine master, and he still did. Only a new approach was necessary.
"Jai?"
Morella's wide eyes were narrowed into a look of concern. Oh, gods, he'd done it again. "Sorry, Morella. My mind is heavy on this night."
"Is it because of the Black Tears' escape?"
Jig, Morella's son, asked. The straw-haired boy was literally bouncing with excitement.
"No, idiot. It's because of his arm,"
Viola, Jig's older sister, said. The young girl was the spitting image of her mother, from the coppery hair to the round blue eyes to her heart-shaped face. Her hair was beginning to grow long again, a requirement for all female slaves, while Jig's was chopped short. The family was of Terran descent, and in their culture it was the males who usually wore their hair long. Jai was only half Terran, his mother having been a slave, but his eyes had none of the narrowness typical of Phoenicians.
"I'm not an idiot. You're an idiot,"
Jig retorted, pushing his sister. Morella cleared her throat and raised a single finger, and that was all it took for the siblings to quiet down.
"Viola, you will not call your brother any names. Is that clear?"
The girl nodded meekly, while Jig beamed. The boy's grin faltered, however, when Morella turned her wrath on her son.
"And you will not push your sister, correct?"
"Yes, mother."
"Good."
Jai smiled in appreciation of the stern but warm woman he'd been friends with for more than 5 years. She'd faced enough heartache and tragedy to make the strongest of souls falter, but she hadn't. Nor would she ever, Jai knew.
"How is your arm?"
she asked now. Viola leaned closer to Jai, batting her eyes at him. The girl was naught but 12, but she'd been infatuated with Jai since she was 9. Jai cradled his left arm against his body, while using his right to use the bread to scoop up some mushed beans.
"Could be better, but it won't kill me."
"Now you're like me," Jig said, "except with your arm instead of a leg."
The comparison seemed to make the boy happy.
"Correct you are, young Emperor,"
Jai said. The nickname made Jig giggle and Viola roll her eyes. The leg will be next, Jai thought. If his plan was to work, the injuries needed to be believable, if temporary. Earlier that day he'd thrown down his pick in sight of Garadia's mine master, Axa. Axa, who was in on the plan, had reacted the only way he could, with extreme violence. He'd thrown Jai to the ground and kicked him repeatedly in the arm. Jai had to hand it to him. The man could kick. He thought it might be broken, but he wasn't certain. Axa's eyes had met his for a spare moment as the master walked away, and Jai had seen the self-loathing in the man's expression. Jai relished seeing that look, because it gave him hope. Not in the world, but in people. Axa had once been the nastiest, most violent of Jai's mine masters, and yet he had changed for the better. All it took was his enslavement, seeing what it was like. He'd walked many miles in the shoes of his victims, and found compassion in his heart somewhere during the journey. Even the sting of his betrayal at the Southron gates had faded. After all, Jai knew it wasn't his fault. Axa had been cursed with a slave mark at the time. And now he was helping Jai in the exact manner Jai had requested, by beating the living rock dust out of him. If Sonika and her tears could escape, so could he. He would walk right out the front door, none the wiser.
61. The Southern Empire, Fenia. Falcon Hoser. Falcon Hoser, newly anointed Phoenician emperor, had a real mess on his hands, and he felt utterly unprepared for it. His father, the slave master, was supposed to live forever. He now realized how ridiculously foolish that belief had been, how childish. "I am no emperor," he thought now, sitting in the very chair that said the opposite. The plush throne was so big, and yet his father had always seemed to fill it so completely. Falcon was positively swimming in it.
"More like drowning," he thought,
as the three generals approached.
"No, not the generals," he thought. "My generals."
As they approached, he glanced back at his younger brothers, Fang and Fox, each of whom looked utterly unperturbed by the situation, their white powdered faces and narrow eyes expressionless. Behind them, the three great pillars rose to the ceiling, seeming to bear the weight of the world upon their backs. Each was etched with a different marking, the fist, the sword, and the whip, symbols of violence and justice. At least that was what he'd been taught as a young boy. The fist for brothers, the sword for enemies, and the whip for slaves. Falcon turned to face his generals, using the one talent that had served him better than any thus far, faking it. Growing up a hoser had forced Falcon to either pretend to be like his father and brothers, or be stomped beneath their collective trod. So he did, day after day. As a young boy, he'd mastered Fenru before either of his younger siblings, and then he'd used it to defeat them in hand-to-hand combat again and again, until they knew he couldn't be beaten. Sometimes, afterwards, as he rinsed the blood from his hands and feet, he would dry-heave into the wash-basin. When he turned 12, Falcon had his head shaved, save for a narrow scythe of hair down the center. Gaudy emeralds were supposedly sewn into his scalp. He pierced his ears and adorned them with diamonds. He powdered his face daily in the way of his people. And now, just yesterday, in the traditions of Phoenician emperors of the past, he'd had his eyebrows permanently removed, sewing jewels in their stead. To anyone who couldn't see into his heart, he was a Phoenician emperor, haughty, powerful, and absurdly wealthy.
"Speak," he said now,
addressing the general in the center, a grizzled veteran of war named Killorn. The man stood up straight, his dark eyes devoid of fear. He wore leather battle armor, flexible enough to flip and spring in. His chest bore the four-eyed lioness, the symbol of Fanes. Strapped to his footwear were blades. Similar blades were lashed to his wrists. This man had killed hundreds, if not thousands, of foes in battle. He was violence in the body of a man, and he bore the scars to prove it.
"Before he died, your father chose not to repair the two destroyed gates," General Killorn said. "I know this," Falcon said. "He wanted to welcome our enemies across the border. He wanted war."
The general nodded.
"We are prepared. Those north of us believe our defenses have been weakened, but it is the opposite. The slave army is stronger than ever, 10,000 strong. Prepared. Trained."
Falcon shook his head, trying to hide his discomfort at all this talk of war.
"But not loyal. Before, my father controlled them with magic. Now they could easily drop their weapons on the battlefield and join the ranks of those who march upon us."
The general smiled, which made Falcon frown. What was this man not telling him?
"Your father was a man of secrets, even from you," he said.
Falcon's frown deepened. This was not what he had expected. He'd been ready to declare that the gates be rebuilt, that war be averted, or at least delayed.
"What secrets?" "The slave army was never marked by chains. Your father never controlled them the way he did the other slaves."
Falcon didn't need to ask why. It all became clear in an instant.
He knew he'd be killed eventually.
It wasn't a question, but the general said,
"Yes. His life was threatened daily. He pretended it didn't affect him, but he prepared for his eventual death. He wasn't willing to risk his army's loyalty on his Tatuya alone. For his army, he only used child slaves, those he could mould into warriors, those he could influence, those he could break. This army is his legacy. You're saying the slaves are loyal to Fanes? They are obedient, which is almost the same thing. If you're asking whether they will fight for you, the answer is yes." Deep inside himself, Falcon sighed. On the exterior, he forced steel into his eyes, his expression. He said, "Good. Then we shall plan for war. May our enemies' blood run like rivers through the desert."
Falcon was preparing for bed. First, he wiped the powder from his face. Then he removed the jewels from his scalp, eyebrows, and ears. He couldn't bear the weight of them any longer. Not the weight on his skin, but on his soul. For he had seen the mines, the slaves toiling in those horrid places. None knew the gems weren't truly sewn into his skin, but only stuck on each day, using the adhesive sap from the Liptus tree. His father was a man of secrets, yes, but so was he. Beside his father's enormous bed, the same bed Vin Hosa had been murdered in, Falcon prepared a thin mattress and pillow. He needed no blanket, as the Southron air was hot and thick. The first night after being made Emperor, he had tried lying in the bed, but tossed and turned uncomfortably for several hours before shifting to the floor. He'd slept there ever since. Hidden in his bedroll was a book, one he'd procured in secret. He'd read it half a dozen times already, as he did with most books, before eventually getting a new one. According to his father, literature was for women, whereas men should focus on things of substance, like training, power, and wealth. His father had only made exceptions for true works, which he had read to his sons so they could learn from the past failures and successes of their ancestors. This particular book would have turned his father's face red in anger. It was fiction, for one, a story invented by a famous dreadnought storyteller. The story was centered around a forbidden love between a man and woman on opposite sides of a bitter war between kingdoms. The man was a prince, the woman a princess. Their fathers hated each other. Their people killed each other. Falcon eagerly turned the pages, soaking in the author's words, the growing suspense as the young lovers were nearly discovered in the throes of rapture on numerous occasions. And yet, despite the risks they faced, they refused to let their love be consumed by the hate between their families. In the end, he knew they would die because of their beliefs, their love. Still, each time he approached those final pages, Falcon hoped their story might change, that they might escape, sail to a faraway land where they could live in peace and happiness. And each time he was disappointed as they died in each other's arms, killed by their own kin. 62. Unknown location. Bane Garrick. Bane, killer of kings, destroyer of empires, bringer of peace, knew the man would eventually try to kill him. Even as they sat across from each other, breaking bread, drinking wine, he could see it in Chavis's red eyes. The man no longer called himself the beggar, for one. No, he insisted on reassuming his childhood name, Chavos. That was a bad sign. A beggar might need what he had to give. A Chavos? Well, he didn't know what a Chavos might need. In truth, Bane didn't know much about people. Considering his upbringing had been limited to a cold cave and a man named Bear Blackboots. A man who, he was now beginning to realize, wasn't exactly who he had pretended to be. Bane had finally found the man hiding in the vast archives of Citadel, the northern Calypsian city. He was hidden among the stacks, muttering under his breath, searching thick tomes, his fat fingers brushing the pages with unexpected tenderness, as though caressing a lover's hair. Bane, for some reason, felt disgusted by the man he'd once called father. For a long time he considered stealing up behind him, slitting his throat, ending his mutterings. But he didn't. Something about it didn't feel right, and Bane had learned over the course of the last few months to always trust his instincts. After all, they'd gotten him this far. 6 dead rulers, with still 4 to go.
"Can you pass the butter, my friend?"
Chavos said, gesturing toward a silver plate set between them.
"Of course, my friend," Bane said with a smile.
Rather than hand it to him and risk being touched by the plague-riddled man, he slid it across the floor.
"Thank you."
"You're welcome."
Bane hated that he couldn't seem to convince anyone of his mission, the justness of it, the rightness. He was ordained by the Western Oracle, wasn't he? He was created by her. Surely that should mean something. Where others saw only a trail of blood and corpses in his wake, he saw a glowing red path to peace. The rulers of the 4 kingdoms had become far too bloodthirsty, drunk on their own power. He was simply the equalizer. Why couldn't anyone seem to see that? The urge to slash open the man in front of him rose bitterly in the back of his throat, but something stayed his hand. It was need, pathetic human need, for companionship, for a friend. Even a false friend felt better than none at all. And so he smiled and ate, waiting for that inevitable moment when one of them would need to kill the other.
63. The Southern Empire, Calip. Rhône-Lorraine. Rhône-Lorraine, having grown up under the vicious glare of the Southron sun, knew better than to attempt to cross the Skara on his own. Instead, after parting ways with his Furia escort on the banks of the Spear, he swam across, taking a few moments to wring out his sodden clothes, and then turned directly south, following the Arrow Strait River toward its end, the Burning Sea. The Burning Sea suited its name well. In the brightness of midday, it appeared to be not water, but a roiling, ever-shifting bed of flames stretching from horizon to horizon. To the west was a burnt wasteland that eventually reached the towering red rock spires that were home to a large colony of vultures, the bloodthirsty sky hunters known to scoop up small children, sinking their claws into the scruffs of their necks. To the east, the land angled southward, forming the narrowest portion of the desert, brown and sun-speckled. Here, along the coast, the Skara wasn't nearly as formidable. The winds were cooler, and the sea provided plenty of food in the form of crabs skittering across the wet rocks. Rhône, of course, wouldn't eat any living thing, instead relying on the bare rations afforded him by Rhea Lorraine before she sent him away. "Rhea Lorraine," he thought. "My sister, the tyrant." He shook his head, still in disbelief that he was back in the empire of his childhood. How had everything gotten so turned around, he wondered. Then again, at the same time, there was a certain symmetry to it all, like his life had come full circle. At least, that was what he told himself, because if fate had brought him here, then perhaps he could still find a way to achieve his goals, namely, find the ancient sorceress known as the Western Oracle, or locate her son, a man who now went by the name Bear Blackboots. And if he could do that, then maybe he could still save his friends, Gareth Ironclad and Gwendolyn Storm. Friends. That word seemed like a lie, because what he felt for each of them went far beyond the bounds of friendship. With Gareth, his love had been like a vial of poison turned over abruptly, spilling its contents, which turned out to be the sweetest wine. With Gwendolyn, the love had grown more slowly, building like a storm on the horizon. Roiling clouds, pattering rain, strikes of lightning, rolling thunder. Gods. Each love was different in a thousand ways, but the same in one, and that one was what drove Rhône now. If his sister wanted the Western Oracle or her son, he would give them to her to save those he loved. But perhaps Rhea would get more than she bargained for. The evening faded into morning, and Rhône stopped to eat and sleep.
The sun was too harsh, forcing him to travel at night, risking a deadly sting from a scorpion or a poisonous bite from a snake, and take refuge under the sparse vegetation during the day. He rose again when the sun set, continuing this pattern for 2 days, until the landscape began to change, his passage cutting sharply toward the east, where a narrow stretch of land jutted out toward the sea, where he saw a remarkable bridge, a long curving scythe of stone connecting the desert to the peninsula known as Kalip. "My home," he strode forward, unafraid. Though it had seemed a much shorter distance, it had taken Rhone the better part of the night to cross the windswept bridge. It was a harrying experience, each breath of wind threatening to blast him into the roiling whitecaps churning far beneath. As expected, dark-skinned Calypsian soldiers blocked his path at the end of the bridge, the final gatekeepers to Kalip. They were frowning at him, at his dusty but pale skin, his blonde-streaked hair, his pale blue eyes. "A foreigner," their expression said, even as their hands closed on the weapons hanging from their belt. Only one of them was a guanero, his bulky frame resting atop a scaled guanic, the beast's pink tongue flicking restlessly from its black lips. He was the one who spoke first.
"You're a long way from home, Westerner."
"I grew up in Calypso," Rhone said. He held out his hands in a gesture that said, "I'm unarmed and harmless." The guanero laughed without breaking his stare.
"And I am Empress Raven Sands. You're no more Calypsian than a grey-skinned dreadnoughter."
"I didn't say I was Calypsian. Only that I grew up here. I've lived in many places, including, most recently, the East." Although Rhone had been expecting a reaction, it came far swifter and more powerfully than he was prepared for. Weapons screamed from their scabbards, rough hands grabbed him and slung him to the hard ground, and he found himself staring at the tip of a sword, which hovered a finger's breadth from his eye. "Something I said," he managed to quip.
"Why were you living in the East?"
the guanero man said, his voice even, all humor sucked from it. Rhone's strategy had made sense up until now. Apparently even mentioning the word East could get you a sword through the eye. He chose his next words more carefully. "I was a prisoner," he said. "The ironclads took me captive. They thought I was a Calypsian spy." The man's gaze narrowed.
"How did you escape?"
"I didn't."
"They let you go?"
"Sort of. Let's just say I earned their trust."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning I have information."
"Information about what?"
"Remove your sword and I'll tell you." The man bit his lip, considering. Then, slowly, he drew the blade back. Not all the way, but far enough that Rhone felt like he could breathe again.
"Speak."
"I know all about Feria's defences. I'll save the details for Empress Raven." The man's lips curled as he showed his teeth. He shoved his blade downward. Rhone flinched as the steel bit into the cracked ground just beside his face.
"Come with me,"
the guanero said, hefting Rhone up by his collar. 64. The Southern Empire, Calypso. Raven Sands. Nestled beneath the shadow of the three massive pyramids, all of Calypso, as well as many of the outlying villages, had gathered for the testing of the Dragonia. This was remarkable, as Raven had explicitly asked that it be kept secret. "Rumors and gossip swirl like winds upon this land," she thought. If nothing else, the testing was a welcome distraction. She'd scarcely been able to think of anything but the words of the message delivered a day earlier. "Stop war, or Whisper dies." It was those 5 words that had shaken her awake in the middle of the night, her entire body trembling. She'd thrust the covers away, feeling suffocated, cold beads of sweat forming on her forehead and running down her spine. Frantically, she'd rushed from her room, bursting through the tinkling barrier of threaded guanic bones and into Whisper's quarters. At first, she thought the bed was empty, so small was her sister's form beneath the sheets. At first, she thought, "Oh, gods, what have I done?" but then she saw her chestnut hair spilling out, saw the rise and fall of her sister's chest beneath her coverings. Raven had stood there for a long time, just watching Whisper sleep, just enjoying the aliveness of her. And when she'd finally left, sleep had been impossible. Still, now, outside amongst her people, the air of excitement was contagious, and she felt herself leaning forward in anticipation. The threat on the note was still there, somewhere in the back of her mind, but she managed to lock it away, at least until she had more time to consider the source. It was hard not to be down there with the dragons, considering she was almost a dragon master herself, given how much time she'd spent with the Dragonia as a child, and as she'd reached womanhood. But she was empress now, and needed to separate herself from individual pursuits, and that included day-to-day monitoring of the dragons. That being said, it was nearly impossible for her not to think of them as her children. The Dragonia numbered 12 in total, as they always did. 6 male, 6 female. No one knew exactly why that was, except that each generation of mates only bore 2 eggs each. Their parents were well past their prime, having descended into madness as their long lives wore on. Some of them had even grown a second head, or, in rare cases, a third. The thought made Raven sad. She hated the way the dragons, like humans, deteriorated with age. Not their bodies, which never stopped growing, but their minds. She shook away the thought as she spotted Heyrun, the largest male of the brood, with his dark, sleek scales and insatiable love of cured bacon. He had been the only dragon that had passed the last testing. Screams burst from the crowd as he snorted a gout of flames from his snout, so close to them that they could probably feel the heat. He wouldn't hurt them, of course. He just had a sense of humour. Raven chuckled, watching Ryder and Shanalyn begin the testing. First were flying challenges, each dragon beating its powerful wings, kicking up dust and small stones, commanded by their masters to perform various tasks. Hover in place. Rise at sharp angles, bursting through clouds. Swoop down sharply, brushing the ground without crashing. Fly in formation. Other, more junior dragon masters rode them as they performed, and Raven found herself envious of them. It had been over a fortnight since she'd been able to fly. There was Ciri, the red-backed female covered in spikes, the smallest but most agile of the brood. She'd long been Raven's favourite, her temperament as prickly as her hide, and yet easily subdued by a belly rub and brace of roasted coney. Beside her was Cronus, the dragon usually ridden by Shanalyn. The hot-tempered beast was almost as large as Heyrun, his grey scales shimmering like silver plate. He obeyed none of the dragon masters but Shanalyn, a fact that had always frustrated Raven. No dragon master should have that kind of power. In the centre of the formation was the bacon-loving Heyrun, Ryder's steed of choice. The enormous male struggled with the flying exercises, his own girth getting in his way, but he still managed to pass. In fact, all 12 of the Dragonia performed extremely well during the flying portion of the testing, each passing. This was no surprise. Flying was to dragons what walking was to humans. Shanalyn and Ryder marked each dragon's scores on a large board, a line drawn for the passing mark. Next, they began fire breathing, which had been the only part of the testing Raven's sister, Fire, had ever really shown interest in. Raven's mouth suddenly felt dry at the memory, and she wished Whisper were here. Her sister, however, still garbed in all black, had refused to attend, calling the event a farce of epic proportions. Fire breathing involved the destruction of various objects, from as small as human dummies to as large as huge stone structures meant to represent enemy buildings or walls. The larger dragons, like Heyrun and Cronus, tended to dominate the destruction of the larger structures, their fires as hot as the sun, oceans of eternal flame, while smaller dragons like Ciri could form more precise streams of flame, capable of obliterating a smaller object from great distances. Again, the Dragonia as a whole performed well, only one didn't pass. Raven realized that at some point she'd folded her hands together, her dueling grips locked together in a sweaty embrace so tight it was beginning to ache. Slowly she released them, though her fingers continued to throb. Was Whisper right? Had she unintentionally agreed to a war if the Dragonia passed the testing? As the dragons continued to perform at a high level with each new phase of the examination,